February marks the anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The conflict looks very far from ending anytime soon, and Russia's victory that everyone was expecting, it hasn't come to pass. There hasn't been a nuclear war yet, as many predicted, or World War III, but all the major powers, they're involved in one way or another. I'm sat down with Geopolity founder Adnan Khan a few days before the anniversary to discuss the Ukraine war and how it's going so far. How are you keeping, Adnan?
I'm good, Yusuf. I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very well, thank you. So now, the first question, obvious place to start, would be, where does the war stand right now after 1 year? How would you summarize what's been going on?
Okay, so Yusuf, in many ways, 1 year is a very short time to look at any conflict. And also, it's also a long time as well, because a lot can actually happen. If you take your mind to a year ago, we saw for many months Russia was massing troops around Ukraine from Belarus all the way around to the Black Sea. And eventually Russia did invade on the 24th of February 2022, so exactly 1 year ago. And what you saw was Russia invaded on three fronts, or three axes. From the north, they invaded from Belarus to go down and capture Kiev. From the east, they invaded from Donbass. And from the south, they invaded from Crimea. So the south and the eastern fronts were probably the most successful. They managed to go up to around 100 miles into the interior of Ukraine. The northern front was probably the worst front. It will probably become a case study of how not to fight a war. And not surprisingly, within 2 months, by April, Russia had given up on taking Kiev. Now, interestingly, by August, the Russian military was calling for the further mobilization of Russian troops. Putin obviously refused, because any further mobilization would mean the war's not succeeding. By September, what we saw was Russia began to lose significant territory. So in the north, in Kharkiv, Russia spectacularly lost to a front by the Ukrainian forces. And then in the south, they were struggling to hold on to the Kherson area. And eventually, Russia actually withdrew to behind the Dnieper River. So it became clear that Russia couldn't hold on to its front line with the low numbers of troops it had. So not surprisingly, Putin called for the general mobilization in September, 300,000 at the time. And he also sacked the war general at the time and replaced him as well. So since then, Yusuf, the fronts Russia have stabilized. Then obviously by December, winter set in and Ukraine begins to freeze. The land becomes very, very hard, and it's difficult logistically to fight in this sort of environment. So what we found really is in December, both the Ukraine and Russia are getting ready for their spring offensives. And it will probably seem Russia has actually started its spring offensive already. So it looks as though where we are, Russia plans to throw its mobilized troops into the war. They are looking to hold on to what they've already taken and try and expand that further. Ukraine is looking to make Russia's occupation very difficult. It's going to try and make it all for them, but they are completely reliant upon Western arms in order to do this. So in many ways, where we are currently after 1 year is Russia's trying to hold on to and stabilize what it conquered. And what Ukraine is trying to do is make what Russia's taken very difficult, and from spring, try and actually start pushing back against them.
Now, I'll be honest, from a spectator perspective, I feel like Ukraine's actually doing not bad, better than expected. Is that really because Ukraine's doing well, or is it because Russia's just doing so badly?
It's actually a bit of both. I think everyone's surprised how badly Russia did. All the intelligence agencies, even America's CIA, were saying Ukraine stands no chance on a Russian onslaught. Russia is bigger, more quantity. Ukraine will be overwhelmed. And in fact, the CIA reportedly was telling Ukraine to get ready for the guerrilla war once they've actually lost. However, what we find is Russia has really performed poorly in the invasion. And interestingly, Yusuf, this isn't the first time Russia's done that. Russia generally starts wars badly. It makes adjustments and then it wins in a really ugly way. We saw this in Chechnya throughout the 1990s. We saw this in World War II against the Nazis. But there were some very, very basic things which we can look into that Russia got wrong. And it seemed a lot of it was just based on Russia themselves were convinced this would be an easy war. We will just drive all the way to Kiev. the government's really, really unpopular. We just overthrow them and people will accept the occupation and conquest. And it seems what Russia did, rather than plan for the worst case scenario, they actually planned for the best case scenario. And when things went wrong, they took a long time to actually adjust. So it seems as though Russia now is just focused on the line that goes from the northeast of Ukraine all the way down to Crimea. So you think after a year, you probably would have taken more territory, but Russia seems to now realize they need to consolidate these particular areas. So Ukraine has done well, and everybody had written them off. Yes, they've done well because they've got significant Western help, support, intelligence and equipment. But Russia hasn't performed well. However, now it's making adjustments.
Now, I get all that. Russia's performed quite badly. Now, this question's cropped up time and time and again. Why wouldn't Russia ever consider just using nuclear weapons to get the job done quickly?
So, yeah, in theory, you're absolutely right. Why wouldn't any nuclear nation just within, what, an hour or two drop a nuke, you've won the war, it's over. But you find all the nuclear powers have never done this. And in fact, the nuclear powers have actually lost wars and still not used their nuclear weapons. What you find, Yusuf, is all the powers, when they go to war, they go to war with the understanding and intelligence that the enemy is weak, we're stronger, and we'll be able to overwhelm them. So they feel their conventional power is sufficient to win. So in both world wars, the Germans believed within a matter of months, we can defeat Russia. So Hitler, if I remember correctly, the Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of Russia, started in June. And Hitler was so confident they could conquer Russia before winter set in, the German troops weren't even provided with winter equipment or clothing. America, when it invaded Afghanistan in 2001, believed they'd be home for Christmas. So they never planned for a 20-year occupation. So this is pretty normal. Most armies go to war thinking they can win. They look at the enemy and you obviously get a bit of bias and then they're forced to actually adjust. So in the case of Russia, the problem you've got with nuclear weapons there is this is a country on your border, Ukraine. Russia's intention is they want to politically control Ukraine. They don't want Ukraine to become European or become Western. At a minimum, what they want is political control over the country. And nuclear weapons wouldn't solve that. Nuclear weapons would create a massive radioactive crater on their border. Keep in mind, the north of Ukraine is 300 to 400 miles away from Moscow. And nuclear radioactive fallout doesn't respect borders. So from that perspective, Yusuf, nuclear weapons don't necessarily serve their purpose. They want to conquer Ukraine and use it as a buffer zone. A radioactive buffer zone isn't a buffer zone anymore, even has an impact on you as well. Where I think Russia may consider using nuclear weapons, Yusuf, is in two scenarios. One is if their army completely capitulated. And this has happened before. This has happened in Russia's history, where Russia's armies got, in World War One, they were completely capitulated, because this would be very embarrassing for Russia today if that happened. And the second scenario is if the Ukrainian forces take back what Russia's conquered of Ukraine and then they go further into mainland Russia. In that scenario now, Russia proper is under attack. And if you look at Russia's military doctrine, it's based around defending and protecting the Russian land, the Russian border. So they're the only two scenarios I think they will consider it. Beyond that, you know, nuclear weapons, it shows Russia can't be messed with. Russia's powerful. And I think Ukraine's realized the hard way today that if they didn't give up their nuclear weapons in 1991, the situation may be very different today.
Mentioned earlier on, one was about Russia's mobilization in September. What does that actually tell us about the state of Russia's military?
So Russia has this thing, Yusuf, where they have to have a large army. If you look at the Soviet Union, Russia had a 5 million man army. They weren't particularly great. They weren't particularly well trained. They weren't even particularly well armed. However, you can overwhelm anyone when you've got millions of troops. And once the Soviet Union collapsed, Russia struggled to finance a large army. So really, since the 1990s, the Russian military has actually been shrinking. So what Russia has now is you have a small professional corps army of around 170,000 troops. The rest of your army is made up of conscripts. So you don't need to call up conscripts until you go to war. So when you go to war, then you're going to need massive amount of troops. So what you do then is you mobilize troops. So what you have is what's happened now is you call for a general draft where everyone who's from what, 18 to 25, they have to come and sign up for the army. So it's actually illegal now. If you don't come and sign up, you will get arrested, which is actually what's happening in Russia. So what Russia does is you have a small professional corps who you maintain on a full-time basis. This is your active force. They get trained and they get equipment. And this is something Russia can afford. Russia can't really afford a large army. So when Putin sent his troops to go and invade Ukraine, he believed that he could win very quickly with a small force. He doesn't need to call on the broader force. He doesn't need to call for mobilization. So when he called for mobilization, what that meant, the war hasn't gone according to plan. And with the numbers he got, he can't win. So really, mobilization showed Russia is actually losing. It's not actually winning. And now what we're going to see now is Russia's now going to throw lots more of badly trained, under-equipped troops at the war. And this is Russian history. This is what Russia has done historically. So yeah, mobilization actually shows Russia got it wrong. Now, if Russia had sent overwhelming forces in the first place, we may today be talking about Ukraine doesn't exist anymore. It's now been annexed by Russia. We would have had a very different podcast today. But Russia didn't do that. They thought they could win on the cheap. They could win a quick victory. And they're basically now paying for it.
What wrong is their general. You mentioned earlier as well, they've been changing their general a number of times. I can imagine that really destroys the morale of the army. What was their thinking behind that?
So this whole Ukraine war really shows you the relationship between the military and the Kremlin or the elites of Russia. So historically, under the Soviet Union, the military was the main, you could say, spear of Soviet Union. They were central to maintaining Russian power. They were central to expanding Russian power. What's happened since 1991, the military went through a long period of decline. A lot of the equipment became rusted. Russia couldn't afford it. However, Russia needs a military to project an image of strength. The problem here is the military today, their position is very different to the politics of Russia compared to in the past. In the past, the generals effectively played a massive role in running the country. They played a massive role in Russia's global role. Today, that's not the military's role. Today, the military is completely subordinate to Putin and the elites in Russia. So you'll hear from many, many soldiers that Russian soldiers are treated like crap, literally. The fact that they weren't even told about the war until a few hours before they invaded tells you how Putin and the elites around him view the military. In fact, we now know from intelligence what the Kremlin did is they informed the military, here's your strategy, here's the three fronts you're going to fight on, get on with it. And the Russian general didn't actually tell most of their soldiers until hours before they were told to go into Ukraine. Why is this a problem? Because when you go to war, you need to be psychologically prepared. When you go to war, you need to be materially prepared. That actually didn't happen. So what happened was Russia invaded, and for about 6 weeks, there was no overall commander of the invasion. You had three fronts, you had three different commanders. So in order for the Kremlin to get updates, they'd have to go and travel to the front lines or call the actual commander. After 6 weeks, General Novikin was appointed the overall commander of the Ukraine forces. And once Russia struggled with Kiev, once it was clear that they weren't winning anymore, he was removed, and the next general, General Shoigu, he came in. General Shoigu had a very defensive strategy. In fact, he didn't carry out any offensives. And so what you find now in January, now you've got another general, General Gerasimov. He's now taken over, and he's now going to be in charge of the offensive. So what you find, a lot of the generals who have been in charge of this war have failed, or they've been very defensive, which is exactly what Putin doesn't want. Putin needs to show the Russian people and the elites that this war's actually been successful. So that's why you're finding that he keeps changing the generals at regular intervals.
Now, on an international level, I think it's really, really isolated Russia. I know it's one of the most sanctioned countries in the world at the moment, and Europe also has cut any ties with Russia. But obviously, it's not really dampened Russia's resolve in this war. Would you say that the sanctions and then a failure and cutting the energy ties were useless?
So the economic war, Yusuf, is another component of this battle. You've got the actual military aspect, which is the physical war in Ukraine. The other part of the war is the economic aspect. And you're right, what you find from the beginning, the West has put significant sanctions on Russia. Russia, yeah, is now officially the most sanctioned country in history. And we're seeing now the sanctions are starting to have some effect. I think we're going to keep in mind, Russia is the 10th, 11th largest economy in the world. If you look at Iran, North Korea, Cuba, Venezuela, all of these countries face significant sanctions, but the political system didn't collapse. So if they didn't collapse, it's unlikely Russia is going to collapse when it's such a large country, the 10th, 11th largest economy in the world. And also the West have significant experience now on sanctioning countries, cutting them off from international trade. So they, I think, know that sanctions will hurt. It won't necessarily lead to the collapse of Russia, but it hasn't even led to the collapse of other countries that were much more weaker than Russia. However, they're having an impact. So I think at the beginning of January, the finance minister of Russia actually admitted that sanctions are beginning to hurt. And they would, Yusuf, because if you look, up to 40% of Russia's economy is based on energy. So the GDP of the country is 40% from energy. Up to 60% of government revenues come from energy. And then up to 70% of their exports come from energy as well. So if you sanction energy against Russia, it's going to hurt in the long run. So what you find is Europe has completely cut its oil ties with Russia. In response, Russia then cut its gas ties with Europe. And half of Russian, well, 75% of Russian gas went to Europe. And that's why you find in countries like Germany, they've been massively impacted by this. So just last week now, we now know that Russia's energy revenues have been cut in half in the last year since the war began. And that makes sense. Although Russia made a lot of money in the first half of the war, first half, 6 months, that was because countries like China, India, Russia increased energy sales to them and it gave them a massive discounts. Turkey and Iran have also been purchasing Russian energy at massive discounts. So if you're selling energy at a massive discount, it's going to have an effect. Beyond that, what you find is Russia's been cut off from high-tech components, which is essential for their economy. Russian oligarchs have been cut off. Russia's been cut off from the global SWIFT system. And Russia's effectively lost half of its foreign exchange reserves, which were in foreign banks. So sanctions is a long-term regime. Sanctions is also to show that the West are actually united. But I think maybe the West oversold this. They were trying to make it out that the West is a bloc. We're all united. We're putting sanctions on them. Sanctions will have an impact, but I don't think it will lead to the capitulation of Russia in the short term. I think the long-term sanctions can hurt. But I think, Yusuf, just a final bit on this. We've got to keep in mind that Russia has effectively been under sanctions since they first invaded and took over Crimea in 2014. So Putin had a strategy from them. It's called Fortress Russia, which is basically Russia needs to cut its dependency on foreign markets. Because what Putin could see, these sanctions are only going to increase as Russia does more actions around the countries around it. So when these sanctions have come in, Russia was already trying to shift more and more of its energy towards the Asia. Russia was already trying to find alternatives to components that it purchases from the West as well. So really, when you take that all into account, you've got to view sanctions as just one part of an overall strategy. I think some people are trying to sort of sanction that this great strategy that's going to bring the whole Russian Empire down. It's not really like that when you put it into context.
They cut energy ties and you found they switched over to Ukraine, and they've, although they dragged their feet, that in the end they've agreed to give tanks to Ukraine. Why was the whole controversy around this? Because wouldn't the West want to support Ukraine?
So Yusuf, if you take your mind back to when the war started, the response from the West is almost entirely being led by America. It was America who had to force the French and the Germans to get on board now that Russia actually invaded Ukraine. So you find Germany was arguing that sanctions should be a last resort, and the French were arguing we should talk to the Russians when there were massing troops on the Ukraine border. Once Russia invaded, everything changed. Germany, France have all got behind America. However, you've got implications here now. Your number one supplier of energy, if you're going to sanction it, it's going to have an impact on you. So the Germans, obviously, after World War II, have a long history of not engaging in war, of only engaging in economics. And this is what they've been doing with Russia. They've been in the 1900s, the deal they made with Russia for energy was considered the deal of the century. So what you find with the tanks is, I mean, it's quite laughable, some of it. The Germans, in effect, were saying, we don't want to give tanks because we don't want to be at war with Russia. We don't mind supporting Ukraine, but we don't want to do anything that was going to escalate the war. So when America said, you need to give tanks to Ukraine so they can fight, is practical because you are not far from Ukraine. Effectively, what the German chancellor said is, we are only going to give tanks if the Americans give tanks as well. And that's what it's come down to. And I think we've got to keep in mind that Germany has all been about economics since World War II. They thought they could live, they could get both parts of the world here. They thought we can outsource security to America and we can outsource our energy policy to Russia. And what America is now saying is, you need to make a choice. You can't have both. And it seems what Germany has done is jumped into bed with America, and now they've seen the repercussions because they had a very good energy arrangement with Russia, and now that's basically gone. So I'm not surprised the German response. It just made them look very weak, made them look really silly on the international scene, because I think in the end they're only sending about 40 Challenger 2 tanks, and that's nothing. 40 tanks, they need 300 plus tanks. So Germany is dragging its feet. Germany wants to be seen as part of the Western bloc, but it doesn't want to do any of the heavy lifting.
Another country, Moldova, it shares a border with Ukraine. It's recently just closed its airspace after a drone entered its airspace. What are the chances that Russia is actually eyeing out Moldova, and what would that mean strategically?
So this is a very interesting development, literally last couple of days, Yusuf. It makes sense from a Russian perspective. If you want to do something unconventional, if you want to show the West that you have got other tools you can use to win this war, Moldova would be probably the most cost-effective and the most sensible thing to do. So Moldova has a border with Ukraine on the eastern side. Russian presence in Ukraine goes up to Crimea and just above Crimea. So to the west of that, you've still got a bit of Ukraine, and then it turns into Moldova. Now, Moldova, there's a sliver of land where you've got a Russian military presence. And some of this goes back to the Soviet days. This area, the borders have changed quite regularly. So Russia has always had a bit of influence in Moldova. It's only a population of 4 million. And that's what makes it more doable. Ukraine's got a 40 million plus population. Moldova's got 4 million. You've got a Russian presence there. You've even got a pro-Russian presence. This would actually be a good move from a Russian perspective. It's a low-cost, high-impact strategy if they were to actually use it. So I think what's happened last few days, Romania informed Moldova that they spotted drones and even a cruise missile flying through Moldovan airspace. So as a result, Moldova was forced to close the airspace down, thinking they were on the verge of being invaded or something was actually going on. So from a Russian perspective, this actually makes a lot of sense. It's a low-cost thing. It doesn't require them to send troops over. There's already troops there. And actually, they can access Moldova via the sea as well. So again, if this is actually a move from Russia, it's actually a sensible move. It's a low-cost move.
Right. What is Russia's end game now? Can it really take the whole of Ukraine? Can Ukraine win?
So I think, Yusuf, Russia started off wanting to conquer Ukraine. They've had to adjust. I don't think they can conquer Ukraine now. I think strategically, they need to politically control Ukraine. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is, Ukraine is a buffer country for Russia. It can't have Ukraine joining Europe, the EU and the West and NATO. If that happened, West borders come all the way up to Russia. And if they take Ukraine, Ukraine's north is just 300 miles away from Moscow. And this is a centuries-old battle. The Europeans or the West have been pushing their borders as much as they can into Russia, and Russia's been pushing its borders the other way. So strategically, what resolves that for Russia? Now, conquering Ukraine would have resolved that. That's not on the cards now. Now, at most, they can conquer parts of Ukraine. I think what Russia needs to do is stabilize the region it's got, try and expand that a little bit, and then start talks. And then probably in another 5 to 10 years' time, they will make a go of the rest of Ukraine. I think at the moment, their sole strategy is military. And that hasn't, it's been a year now, that hasn't really succeeded. So now that Russia's mobilized troops, it's going to throw more troops at its front, and it's going to try and use that to achieve what it can. From the Ukrainian perspective, they don't want to negotiate. They obviously want all their country back. They want Crimea back. And that's what they're still arguing at the moment. For them to achieve that, they need to make it hell for Russia in the areas they're already occupied. And for Ukraine to do that, they need Western military support. So that's why they've been getting missiles, they're getting tanks, and there's talk of fighter jets as well. And it seems the West is happy to only drip feed them rather than give them everything that they actually want. I think from the Western perspective, America's in it for the long game. America would like to drain Russia. Russia also feels they can wait out the West. Western support, Western public opinion, they believe will wane, and that will allow Russia to actually win. So really, for a Russian victory on the battlefield, they need to survive the sanctions as well, and they need to maintain what they've got and basically see out the West. For the West to win, they need to keep funneling arms to Ukraine and make it completely hell for Russia to actually remain there. There's obviously other factors we've got to take into account here, Yusuf. The economies of both Russia and the West, there was an expectation that in the winter, Europe will suffer significantly with the energy that stopped coming from Russia. What's actually happened now that we're coming to the end of winter, first we had a very mild winter in Europe. And because Russia was massing troops 6 months before they invaded, a lot of European countries managed to store a lot of energy in preparation for this. So they've managed to survive the decline in energy from Russia. So in one way, although Russia hasn't done very well, in many ways after 1 year, it's in a stronger position. Ukraine, the problem is they're completely reliant upon Western weaponry, Western military support. Without that, they're not in the war. And Western military support is going to be dependent upon public opinion. Now, next year, Yusuf, 2024, the US has an election. Biden is up for re-election. The UK needs to have an election by the end of next year or by the end of January 2025. And then in 2025, the Germans go to elections as well. So you've got election years going up. And if you're standing or if you're the incumbent, you're not going to want your involvement in the Ukraine war to impact your electoral prospects. All of these things, when you take them into account, when it looks so, Yusuf, we're only at the beginning part of the war. This war's going to go on for a while. It looks like Putin's actually getting ready for a longer war. And the Europeans and the West are going to have to get ready for a long war. And that's going to have a massive impact on everything else. You've got a cost of living crisis going on in the West. You've got very little confidence in politicians and democracy as well. And now you've got a war going on as well. So that's where we really are after 1 year.
One last question for you, Adnan. I always thought that China and Russia were very good allies. But where is China in all this?
China's really had a bit of a schizophrenic approach to Russia's invasion. When Russia initially invaded, China was quite critical of the invasion. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Firstly, a few months before the invasion, Russia and China signed this alliance partnership. So you would have thought Russia would have informed, or actually discussed with China, that they were going to do this. China wasn't happy about this. And then when there were talks of sanctioning Russia and some of the votes that happened at the UN, China actually abstained from even voting for or against it. On the other side, China has criticized what the West are doing. China has come across as though it's supporting Russia in what it's doing. China hasn't actually physically been involved in Ukraine. It's not providing any arms or anything like that. I mean, Turkey and Iran are probably more involved in the Ukraine war than actually China is. And then we find at the beginning of the war, even Taiwan became a hot issue as well. And what this shows you, something quite interesting, Yusuf, for all the talk of an alliance between both countries, what you find is China views Ukraine as Russia's problem. It has nothing to do with it. And Russia views Taiwan as China's problem. It's got nothing to do with it. So China's not happy because what Russia's done has impacted global supply chains. It's impacted the global economy. And China relies on the global economy. So in September last year, at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting in Uzbekistan, Putin publicly accepted that China's not happy. And he effectively apologized for the way things are gone. So he recognized that China's not happy what's going on. And what this is really indicative of is all the talk of an alliance. Really, you've got a partnership. China and Russia have got strategic interests. Some of those interests, they converge. A lot of them, they don't actually converge. And I think China is looking at what America's done to Russia in terms of sanctions and supporting Ukraine. China looks at Taiwan and it can see a similar scenario happening. And China's more integrated into the global economy. By being more integrated into the global economy, any sanctions on China in the future is going to have a massive impact on the Chinese economy. So I think you said it's quite, the Ukraine war very revealing of the real relationship between both countries.
Thank you for your time. If you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolicy.com. You can also learn more on other issues by accessing our website, where you'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. Thank you for listening.